This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome to the Positive Populist podcast. Very difficult to say.
Yes.
But here we are. Very excitingly, Kennedy is here.
Woo!
And so my first question is always, are you, Kennedy, a positive populist?
No, I'm not as big of a fan of populism as you are.
I thought you might say
that. But I love positivity.
There you are. So you're half of it.
I'm a positive individualist.
Okay, so I think of you politically. I was, you know, very pleased you answered that question honestly.
Yes.
Because, you know, some people come on here and they say, yeah, of course,
yeah,
I agree with you, Steve. You know,
I'll
it's your
you
thing. I'll go with your thing. But I always thought of you actually as a libertarian. Is that an inaccurate term?
No, that's a very accurate term.
But you said individualist, which is in many ways much nicer.
Sure.
There's something about libertarian that can be off-putting to people.
Sure, it can. And it can mean a number of different things. But it really is about the power of the individual.
Right. And so...
an individual liberty.
And so tell me how you got to that point.
It's interesting because I was very political in high school. Mm-hmm. I loved politics and music. Mm-hmm. And I did whatever I could to get as close to both of those worlds as possible. And some of the music I listened to was political and, you know, other songs and bands, not necessarily.
Let's just get a bit. Where are we? Because you grew up
around Oregon. Yeah.
Oregon.
Yeah.
That's interesting because I always thought of you as being California-based because when you come and do the show, you got roots here in L.A.,
sure.
But you're saying Oregon.
Yes, I was born in Indiana and raised in Oregon.
Okay.
And then moved to California 3 months after graduation.
Okay.
So I was working on three different campaigns.
Wait, political campaigns?
Yes,
political campaigns. Before we get to that, I want to go back to the music.
Yes.
Very interested in that. So what kind of music?
I liked alternative and punk rock.
Uh-huh.
And some classic rock.
And would you go and go to gigs and throw yourself around and go nuts?
Absolutely.
I have done a bit of that in my time.
Yeah, a little bit of bruising. And, you know, what a great time in London. I'm assuming you were raised in London, right?
Well, I grew up in a town called Brighton on the south coast. It was really good for music.
Great.
Like, really great clubs. Except that for me, when I really got into music, it was more... we're just really getting into the early days of like acid. Actually, acid house was the big thing that I was into, and the early days of house becoming before it went really mainstream.
Yes,
was more my thing when I was going out to
clubs.
I
got into the Manchester.
Oh yeah, of course.
Quite a bit when I got to Los Angeles in 1990 and started working in an alternative radio station, and this was, you know, just like a year and a half pre-grunge.
Yeah.
And it was Charlatans UK.
Charlatans are amazing.
Yeah.
They're like properly amazing.
Yeah, I loved Charlatans. And
there's a track called Sproston Green. I don't know if it's like, it's so good.
Great song.
And they, I'm going to send you the link. Somehow with this, I don't know how people will see this podcast. I'll put the link up somewhere. There's a gig they do, which I went to in the Astoria in London, which is now no longer exists. It's been pulled down and... it was just one of the best, their performance of that song, just one of the best things ever.
Fantastic.
Yeah, really amazing. Charlatans, how amazing. You love Charlatans.
Yeah, so I liked Charlatans and Happy Mondays.
Yeah.
And of course, Susie. And,
of course, Susie and the Banshees. Yeah. Like one of the first gigs I ever went to was Susie and the Banshees.
And the number of bands that came out of Manchester, it's really, it's
how amazing.
Yes.
Okay, so this is all, like, we could do half an hour just on that.
Yeah.
But I also was really intrigued when you said, when you talked about the sort of political music, mm-hmm. what kind of things are you thinking about there?
Well, you know, a lot of punk rock is, it's very anti-establishment.
Right.
And I always enjoyed that. And there were, you know, there was a side that I loved because it was, you know, the Clash and you know, various bands. So it's all about, you know, working hard and kind of sticking it to the man and that is more, you know,
populism. Yes.
Yeah, that there's way more populism in that kind of music. But at the same time, I was a conservative Republican. So there was a natural tension between the music I loved and the bands I looked up to because they probably hated the political figures that
yes.
I admired.
That's so interesting. But when did you think of yourself as a conservative Republican?
In high school. So I started doing youth legislature, and I did Girl State and Girls Nation and, you know, all of these various political programs. And then I started interning for my state representative my senior year in high school. And I did student government, but it's funny because the movie Rushmore resonated with me because I had really bad grades.
Right.
Because I was so busy doing all the extracurricular stuff. And that was the stuff that I was most passionate about. Uh-huh. And I loved arguing about politics and writing bills for youth legislature and really getting into the issues and debates and sitting in school and taking notes and taking tests.
But it's
really
so brilliant. It really connects with you because you've got that comp. Because I had a similar thing where politically I felt like I was definitely on the side of the right, you know, the conservatives. Margaret Thatcher was prime minister. Mm-hmm. I kind of identified with her. My family were immigrants from Hungary, kind of working people. My stepfather was a construction guy, you know, and there's this kind of sense of Thatcher being for the workers, actually.
Yes.
It wasn't the snooty kind of Republican image in the UK back then. Mrs. Thatcher was for the workers, and the Labour Party actually were for layabouts and people on welfare. That was mm-hmm. What I grew up with. And so I had that conservatism, but also this anti-establishment thing. I remember getting in trouble the whole time, you know, kind of arguing with the teachers and leading kind of war. And so that you sounds like you had that same thing going on.
And that's one of the reasons why I consider myself to be a Republican, because it made most of the teachers that I despised so mad. And it was the easiest way to get under their skin was to declare my love for Ronald Reagan. And, you know, I had one teacher in particular that couldn't wait to give me an F. And it wasn't because, you know, I didn't do homework and, you know, I did really well on tests, but turned in no homework.
Right.
So best case scenario, I would get C's, but he found a way to fail me. And he was so delighted about that.
Did you have anyone else who had that combination of what, you know, simplistically you could call right wing politics, but left wing musical taste, in the sense that those bands and music generally is seen as being on the left?
Yes, and they weren't. I didn't realize that they were libertarians until later on, because they tend to be a little bit more heady and less emotional,
right,
and, you know, more logic based. And so they listen to music that, you know, now could be described as mathy.
Right.
And so I was always drawn to people like that. I was always drawn to people who had like an argument for why they loved the songs they did. And I loved Henry Rollins and Black Flag, and, you know, I always thought he was so angry, and I always thought that was so funny.
That's so great. Okay, so then you pursued it as a career. What was the steps between sort of loving it as a kid, and you did all the student government stuff and politics? How did you then
So I didn't graduate from high school. I don't have a high school diploma.
Right.
But I do have a bachelor's degree from UCLA. So I ended up going to college.
Can you do that? I don't know how the system works. Is that okay?
Yeah, when you're an adult. I went to community college for 2 years and tested into math and English and finished the program and then got a scholarship to UCLA.
So did you leave high school with that because you just had enough of learning? And
no,
you wanted to do
I walked commencement. Like, they let me walk and go through the ceremony, but I just didn't get a diploma. And I remember waiting on stage for my name to be called, and the assistant principal looked at me and said, better luck next time.
Wow.
And then the next time I walked on stage, I was 38 weeks pregnant and I was getting my bachelor's degree in philosophy.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's such a great story.
Yeah. It's funny.
That's amazing. So that, and then philosophy, but what about you said you'd worked for a political campaign. You did a bit of.
Yeah. So I was working in politics that summer and I moved to California. My parents knew that I wasn't going to do well languishing in community college. They knew that I was really, really driven and, you know, didn't fit into the community college mold. So they told me they would pay me to leave, or they would charge me rent to stay. So I moved to California.
That's very cool. I like that.
And I'm really appreciative that they did that, because they wanted me to spread my wings. So I promised them that I would go to community college in Southern California. And I did for a couple weeks, long enough to get an internship at a radio station. So then I started working at an alternative radio station.
Music focused, not politics, not like talk radio, political stuff.
No, okay. But the morning show did have some fun at my expense because I was a Republican.
Right.
So they sent me one time to interview Dan Quayle. And this was in 92.
That's terrible just to burst out laughing the minute that his name is mentioned.
I know.
That's very rude, isn't it?
I was obsessed with him.
Even in England, he was famously, you know, someone you should laugh at. That's terrible. I apologize.
He was known as a dum-dum, but there are people in politics who've been far stupider since then.
Yes.
But he gets a bad rap. but I was obsessed with him. I thought he was very handsome. We were both from Indiana. Right. And so I had this weird Dan Quayle fetish. So they sent me to Southern California where he was giving a press conference. And so at the time I had a purple dress and purple hair and purple lipstick. And his press secretary yelled out, last question. And so I yelled out, Vice President Quayle. And he took my question, but I didn't have a question written. So I said, how do I look in purple? And the press was furious because they had all these questions because it was, you know, the summer of the 90s.
Is that a real story?
It's a real story.
You literally asked him that question.
And he goes, you look great in purple.
That's
so, it was so absurd. But he was very nice, and that was my one interaction with the vice president.
Well, there you are, you know, and set you on the path to the glory.
Yeah, and then in my apartment when I got the job at MTV, I had a picture, an official picture.
So wait. You were the radio station. Is that when you next met? The next move was MTV?
Next move was MTV.
We're talking here in Los Angeles.
No,
so.
In New York.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so okay. that was like July of 92, and then in August of 92... My boss from the radio station got a job as a senior vice president of programming at MTV.
Ah, okay.
And was able to get me an audition. And the president of MTV at the time, Judy McGrath, she agreed that I could be hired. And
yeah.
Then I moved to New York.
Wow. And what was your first job there?
MTV VJ. So I was doing...
But do they put you straight... I mean, it's like, were you doing the middle of the night? You know,
I got there Saturday night, and Monday morning I went to work. And then Monday night I was on the air. And it was crazy because I had no training and no...
This is what happened to me here, by the way, to all those who enjoy watching my show. I mean, I couldn't believe that they would give me a live TV show, never having done it before.
Yeah, and they're like, here you go. Here's a studio in Los Angeles. And your studio is beautiful, by the way. It's a great setup. But yeah, they just sort of throw you in and they're like, okay, well,
I know.
Don't screw it up.
So what was the... Because I was in the UK. I didn't just watch it. So I mean, obviously... With MTV, you'd like in the UK, I think we just got the videos. I don't think we had the kind of shows with the VJs. I can't remember. Maybe it's a different MTV Europe. Yeah. That's right. It's a different thing. Okay.
Yeah, and it was totally different. Different programmers, different
VJs. That's right. So what were you doing?
Same format. I was hosting a nightly alternative music show.
Uh huh.
And it was great.
Just introducing acts and videos?
And then eventually, and it took about 6 months. Eventually, they let me actually interview bands.
Wow.
It took so long because they didn't trust me. They thought I was very impulsive. And
did they think of you as the Republican?
Or
did they even know that you keep it secret?
No, I told people because, again, it made people mad and that made me happy. And it was in, you know, obviously in November of 92, Bill Clinton was elected.
Right.
So I got there in September. Clinton was elected in November, 2 months later. And I was like, this is the death of our country. This, and I was very dramatic about everything because I was 20 and I was like, oh, but it was, you know, very, very fun.
So it's interesting, though, because in those days, so it sounds all along, you were not at all embarrassed by being a Republican, even though you were in settings where that was not the norm.
Yes,
to be
but if someone were on MTV on a regular basis and claimed to be a Republican, they would be run out of the city and certainly out of the building and out of the company. They, you know, they had a level of curiosity and tolerance that doesn't exist today. And when I interviewed Pat Smear for my book that came out in 2013, he even said that. He's like, there's no way you could have said then what you say now and kept your job. Things are so polarized and people are so entrenched that they would not have been tolerant of someone who was on the other team.
Yeah. And then how long were you there?
5 years.
Uh-huh.
Solid.
What's the next move?
The next move was Seattle. And then I did talk radio in Seattle, and it was really fun. And then
When you're doing and did you get the chance to be more political then?
Yes. So that's when I really found my libertarian voice.
Right.
And I had at that point I was defining myself as a Republican, a registered Republican, but an ideological libertarian.
Right.
And you know, I learned a lot more about limited government and economic theory. And, you know, got to talk about things at a very politically interesting time in a really interesting place like Seattle.
Yeah.
Which the thing about Seattle, and especially with talk radio, really only Seattle itself is liberal. The rest of the state is very conservative.
Uh-huh.
So it made for, you know, crazy phone calls and a lot of disagreement. And it was a fun place to broadcast. And then I got a job in Los Angeles and moved there. And then I stayed in L.A. for, like, gosh, 15 years.
And doing radio again?
radio, and then that's when I went to college.
Uh-huh.
And some TV, I was hosting game shows for Game Show Network, which was really fun.
Wow.
Yeah.
That I didn't know at all.
Yeah, and then I put myself through college. I was a panelist on a show on VH1 called Best Week Ever.
Right.
And that's how I put myself through college. Even though I had a scholarship, but still I had to pay for like books. And
then how'd you end up at Fox News?
I had met Roger Ailes in 1993.
Right.
Before he started Fox News, and someone had given me a copy of his book because I was so dour. I had no expressions on camera when I first started at MTV. And so a guy gave me a copy of his book as if to say, you know, you have to learn how to be a broadcaster. Because I had the voice part down from doing radio.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I met him and he signed my book. And when I was promoting a book that I'd written in 1999, he called me into his office and said, you know, I want you to move to New York and be a part of Fox News. And I said, I just moved to Seattle. I can't leave. Can I fly back and forth? He's like, no, we really need you here. And then I met with him again. Actually, I met him a few times because I was doing a show for a different Fox cable network.
Uh-huh.
And I would see him at Upfronts and I would be like, what's up? And then and we never had inappropriate or untoward conversations. And then in 2011, they agreed to kind of give me a try. And then 2012, John Stossel hired me to be a correspondent on his show on Fox Business.
So I think of him as the libertarian.
Yes.
And you as well. So that's that was the fit. And so when they sort of brought you on board, they had you down ideologically as a libertarian.
Yes.
Okay.
And everyone knew that.
And they wanted a piece of that.
Yes.
Because that's not the sort of, I mean, I wasn't here then, but you kind of think of Fox News as being, I suppose, it's, as you say, it's part of the story, part of the conservative story, that aspect of it, but more kind of mainstream Republican conservatism, and that the libertarianism is a bit kind of on the edge of that. Do you think that's right, or do you think it actually was more central all along?
I think it's right, and I think there are a lot of people who consider themselves to be conservatarians. They're constitutionalists, right. They believe in limited government, and they just have some more conservative values than traditional libertarians. But a lot of younger viewers and younger voters, even though they don't call themselves libertarian, they tend to be a little bit more libertarian, especially when they skew center-right.
And it's interesting because one of the things that I've always, you know, questioned is why is it, given the emphasis, even within mainstream conservatism, let alone the libertarian version, on freedom, why it isn't, in a way, the kind of the demographic profiles of the parties or the ideologies aren't just completely reversed, in the sense that you want that, you know, that sense of freedom should be more appealing to younger people. But it just doesn't seem to work like that generally across the population.
In some ways, when it comes to religion and marriage and expression, all of those things, you know, especially with millennials, they embrace freedom.
Yeah.
But, you know, each side of the spectrum has their limits to freedom. And I love freedom. I think we should have more freedom in every realm, in every way possible.
And how do you see it in terms of the broad range of issues? And I think one thing that maybe some assumptions that I'm bringing to it, that word, the word libertarian in the UK, in UK politics, is very much associated with, you know, the personal behavior aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So being, you know, particularly sex and drugs and that kind of thing.
Yes, but that's
less on economics or government and so on.
See, I think the economic aspect is just as important as the choices that we make as individuals. And, you know, that's what do you put in your body? Who do you put in your body? All that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, that should be left up to the individual unless you're hurting someone.
Right.
Or taking something from someone else.
Right.
You know, those are cardinal rules that you don't violate. Other than that, leave me alone.
Yes. But it's and in the UK, so for example, there's one of the politicians I work with in the UK, he had this saying when he was talking about, you know, the kind of the overlap and the distinction between libertarianism and conservatism in the UK sense.
Mm-hmm.
He used to say, he had this kind of line, which, oh, libertarians are conservatives who haven't had children yet.
That's funny.
And his thing was, once you have kids and a family, suddenly you lose all that kind of, yeah, everyone do what they want, because suddenly you become more conservative in your social attitudes.
That's interesting because I, since having children, have had a greater yearning for freedom because I want them to be free, but I also want them to take responsibility for their own actions. And I think personal responsibility is such a critical component. And that's something that we've almost completely lost sight of on, you know, on all angles of the spectrum.
Yes.
And that's very unfortunate. And that's one of the most important things I try to impart to my girls is you have to, you know, only take what you can carry. And you have to take responsibility for your choices.
Yes.
Therefore, you know, make better choices. So
I just think that's so true. I think I've said this before on the show. And well, I'll kind of murder the quote now because I can never remember the exact quote. But there's a incredibly famous quote. Not famous. It's famous to me because I really like it. And it makes this point. And it's about this question of self-restraint versus restraint from the government. I think it's a Locke quote, and it's you know, it's something like men can have freedom in exact proportion to their propensity to put moral chains upon their appetites. Mm. The more that they do it from within, the less that they need it from without. And it's kind of getting at that balance. You need less government if people are more responsible.
Yes, absolutely right.
And it's that sense of people just doing what they want in the end means you have to have more government. But that's not always understood about libertarianism. It's that the kind of notion of it as a free-for-all is quite part of how people see it.
And it's interesting because, like, it's not necessarily libertine.
That's not right. That's the crucial word, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's a differentiation. It's not about, I just want to shag everyone and do a bunch of drugs. Like, I don't. That sounds exhausting and horrible. You know, I really want to pursue my passion and my dreams.
Yes.
And I want to be a good mom. And I want the space to do that without someone infringing on my ability to pursue those great things. And, you know, people are better at making their own mistakes than government is at trying to correct them.
Mm-hmm. So what do you make of where we are now in politics, where you've had this, you know, since the arrival of Donald Trump and that populist sentiment? And you've always been very consistent about that. When we've talked about things, you definitely take a different position. But what do you, just stepping back from it, what do you think that says, that the Republican Party has fallen for this approach, which is really very different to the libertarian approach?
I'm fine with it as long, like, I love the idea of Amity Schley's Forgotten Man.
Mm-hmm.
And when she talks about Calvin Coolidge and, you know, the history of the United States in the early 20th century, I think all of that is very interesting. And there's something to be said for that. And those are the people that the Democratic Party completely forgot about when they became so obsessed with identity politics. I just don't want it to veer into the collective. And that's always my worry with populism. Mm-hmm. Like, anything that smacks of groupthink or collective action, like, that puts you on the road.
Do you mean by that but government intervention?
Yes.
You think I think that's fair. I mean, I think that is the thing that makes it different. I mean, I would say there's huge overlaps between all of these ideas, between conservatism, libertarianism, and that, what I would call positive populism.
Yes.
Which is this, you know, there's so many things that are overlapping there, you know, particularly. And when it comes to policy, you know, whether that's tax cuts or deregulation and that skepticism of big bureaucratic government. On the other hand, I think the populist approach does allow for more government role in solving problems or getting involved in markets, for example.
And from a libertarian point of view, you look at government failures, and it's a long and rich history and a very consistent one. And it just doesn't make sense that government has failed so many times in so many ways. How is the solution ever more government? And that's one of the things that I come back to constantly. It's like with healthcare, the reason healthcare and housing are so screwed up is because there's so much government involvement. And, you know, leftists especially want to lean on government even more. But, you know, the natural conclusion is, well, you'll have an even bigger failure.
Yes.
And that's what I would like to.
I totally agree with you on that. I mean, in my book, there's a section on housing, not a particularly long one, but I think it's so crucial to every, you know, when you talk about people's economic security and opportunity, and that's such a big part of it, whether you can afford a home, where you live and so on. And the exactly as you say, the reason, and actually, funnily enough, there's an interesting overlap with populism there, because my take on it is that the reason it is so bad and housing is so expensive, particularly, you know, in California, for example, yes. all these rules that are put there, the zoning rules, the regulations, where you can build, what you can build, all that kind of stuff.
Rent control, exactly. rent stabilization.
That all, that's government action, but it totally favors the establishment players, the yes. big the corporations, the owners of property, the big housing companies and big property companies who know how to play the rules, and they can pay all the kind of local lobbyists that go and, you know, deal with the local politicians and give them money and all that stuff. So it's corrupt in that true populist sense. And so what I argue for is a total lifting of all of those regulations. Yes. So you can basically literally build, like my proposal is that you basically designate all land is one of two things, either developed or not, or nature, mm-hmm. which you protect, because I, you know, I don't want to see
built. I
don't
have a problem with that at all.
And then once you've said, okay, this is developable, you do what you want. Literally, you build, anyone can buy it, anyone can build what they want.
But also let the market dictate that, because yeah. when you have the unnatural introduction of government forces into things like real estate, it really skews prices and vacancies. And that's one of the biggest problems, because if you keep prices unnaturally low, you're not going to have any vacancies. So what happens to the places that are vacant? Well, then those rents skyrocket.
Yes.
So you can't have rent stabilization in every home, in every area. And, you know, the thing I don't understand about Manhattan is, why is there this moral obligation that everyone from every bracket deserves to live in Manhattan? I don't deserve to live in Bel Air. I can't afford a $16 million house. Should there be subsidized housing in Bel Air? No.
I know. It is crazy. And it's such a sense. It's not discussed enough, because it's one of those policy issues that is not as kind of sexy as whatever, immigration or whatever, but it so affects everyone's life. It's amazing. I want to ask you about the Libertarian Party and the presidential candidates and all of that over the years. Have you ever gotten involved with them? Or
No, I'm not a registered Libertarian. I'm actually right. in California, an unaffiliated voter.
Uh-huh.
So, and you know, California now has open primaries, which is great.
Yeah.
But I know they have really great intentions, but sometimes they impose these purity tests that keep really smart people out of the process. And even with the purity test, you end up with people like Bill Weld, and he was horrible for the Libertarian Party, and he didn't do any good.
Yeah.
He promised to raise a bunch of money and raise the profile, and then there's this funny contradiction, because Libertarians don't want any help from the government, but if you cross that 5% threshold, you get campaign finance matching, you know, presidential matching, which is hysterical, because, you know, some libertarians are like, oh, if we get to 5%, it's like, what? You want a handout now? You hypocrite? So hopefully this year you'll see better candidates and smarter people running who really do want to get on the debate stage and challenge the state.
Oh, make the argument.
Yes, at
okay.
both parties. And they thought, you know, I think a lot of libertarians thought with Ron Paul being mm-hmm. as successful as he was in 2012, maybe that was a nice foundation for mm-hmm. an expanded libertarian horizon. And so in 2016, before President Trump got in, they just assumed that Rand Paul would be the front runner and that it would be a liberty-driven Republican
Rand
platform.
Rand Paul.
Rand, yeah.
And that he would make the argument from within the Republican
mm-hmm.
Party. Okay. Is that who's doing that now? I mean, he's still at it. He's
yes.
still consistent. Do you think of him as being consistent on all this?
He's pretty consistent.
Yeah.
You know, I like him, and I don't have a problem with him finding areas of agreement with the president. I think that's very pragmatic.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't agree with everything. And then sometimes he goes rogue and Republicans get really mad. But that's kind of what they paid for.
That's
you know,
exactly
they know exactly what they're getting with him. But there are, you know, a couple of younger congressmen like Justin Amash and Thomas Massie who love being a bee in their Republican bonnet. And I think it's fantastic.
Well, that's...
And they also are very good about explaining every single vote they make. And their constituents love them.
That's interesting, because we're speaking just at the time when the president's emergency declaration over the border is being voted on. And Justin Amash was one of the, he's very clear
yes.
that is a step
you
too far. And
you
don't want to.
You cannot just declare an emergency. You can't just make up an emergency out of nothing and then say, this is so, I need billions of dollars.
But that's it's an interesting argument, because he's a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes the, and
there
so with Rand Paul.
There are people who want him to run as a Libertarian.
Do you think that's a good idea, or is better, more impactful to make the argument within the Republican
for
family?
Him, for these people, I think as Congress, you know, men and women.
Yeah.
I think it's better for them to work within the Republican Party.
Yeah.
I think Justin Mosh could do great things running for president as a libertarian.
Interesting.
And
okay.
They're really trying to draft him to do that.
Draft, and you back that.
I don't have a problem with that.
Very good. Interesting. All right. So we've got to bring it back to music, Kennedy, because
sure.
That's where you started. And I've got a very important question for you, which is, what do you think of President Trump's music choices, particularly the one choice that is that every single rally forever, now he's totally consistent on this, ends with that Rolling Stones song.
You can't always get what you
right.
Want.
I mean, what's that? I mean, what do you think of that?
It's so strange because
it is, isn't it? Like, what's that about?
Yeah, and is that saying, well, I may not be what you wanted, but you can't always get what you want.
You get what you need, you know, like, okay, it's a sort of a responsibility
thing. Maybe he just
thing.
Likes the song.
I think that's right, which is great, by the way.
Yeah.
I remember when I was working for David Cameron, and we were friends as well, and we were sort of hanging out on a summer vacation down in the kind of West Country in England while we were putting together the kind of ideas and plans for his... the leadership campaign when he ran to be leader of the British Conservative mm-hmm. Party, and a bit like a primary, I guess. And the Killers had their album out, and we're just listening to it the whole time.
Yeah.
And so we just used a bit of one of those tracks because we really liked it for his walk-on music. And I just think it's so. I know I've always wondered that with the president, why that track?
And I know, it's so funny.
It's like they haven't changed it all these
and
years.
And it was funny because he was using Twisted Sister, We're Not Gonna Take It, for a while, and I thought that was really funny until Dee Snider got really mad and then kind of disavowed his friendship with Donald Trump. So these things are there. It's great because music doesn't always make sense.
Yes,
it doesn't. And sometimes you like things and you can't explain why exactly you like them, and you know, I've given up trying to be cool. Like, I no longer try to be cool. I just listen to what I really, really like.
Does that even extend to 80s pop music?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, well, there you are. Yeah, so yeah. I guess that has, because there was a time when that was so embarrassing to like some of that stuff, but I get a sense it's becoming a bit cooler.
Oh, it's so great. And even, you know, like Animotion and you're my obsession. You're
my
obsession.
Oh my God, exactly.
Yeah, I love that stuff. And Berlin, and you know, even like Putting on the Ritz by Taco.
Oh my gosh. Okay, that is pushing it too far, but
yeah.
I think...
I know, I'm not cool, I told
but
you.
I totally... Well, you've definitely proved that, and you are not a positive populist. We've proved that.
A positive?
But you're definitely positive.
A positive individualist.
And we love that, so that's great. Kennedy, thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.